From WXXI News, this is the Summer of Food on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the Kashmir region of the Himalayas over a cup of warm tea. The man drinking it, an anthropologist, says he was nervous about the milk and water mixed into the drink since there might have been sanitation issues in the village. And he didn't want to refuse the offer or sacrifice his research project, so he drank it. And the context here is important. The anthropologist was conducting surveys about diarrhea in the village's children. But when he tried to speak to his first family about the illness, he wasn't making much progress. He lacked a connection with the family. They might not have trusted him. And that's where the tea comes in. When a woman labeled some chai into his cup and he gulped down the rich and creamy liquid, everyone in the room broke into a more natural conversation. The research questions were set aside, and the anthropologist and the family just focused on getting to know each other. The family accepted him and welcomed him into their culture, all with the help of that cup of tea. It paved the way for a future productive conversation about the research. That interaction happened about 30 years ago, but the value of the lesson has stayed with the anthropologist throughout his career. Understanding a community's food culture builds trust and can break down barriers, two concepts that are critical in conducting field research in remote communities. Been looking forward to this conversation for a long time, and we're welcoming the anthropologist you just heard about. Dr. Tim Dye is the Associate Chair of Research in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Rochester Medical Center, a medical anthropologist and a social epidemiologist. Did I get it right?
You did. Thank you.
It was great to have you. I know you've had these wonderful experiences. Thanks for being here, Tim. Also joining us in studio is Lauren Farovich. And Lauren is a PhD candidate in translational biomedical science at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry, and has worked with Dr. Dye and is here to also share stories of food adventure and food culture with us. Lauren, welcome to the program. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for having us here.
And Lauren, we're going to hear a voice of a friend. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I am deaf, so I'm using an ASL interpreter, American Sign Language interpreter. And so I actually have two interpreters here. I have Jacqueline and Alyssa. So they'll be interpreting between American Sign Language and English. So you'll be hearing a woman's voice, but it is actually me, a man, speaking.
All right, so I will start with Lauren. I want to ask both of you, did you grow up considering yourselves to be adventurous eaters? Lauren.
Well, I guess a long time ago, I guess it started in high school. I was living in Arizona, and there's a lot of Hispanic and Spanish influence there, and I had friends that would pick on me and offer me all kinds of crazy food, things that I didn't even know the ingredients of. And, you know, at one point I was eating cow tongue in soup. And I was surprised to find that it didn't bother me. I didn't think it was that big of a deal. And I think everything kind of stemmed from that and started from that.
How old were you when you ate the cow tongue?
Oh, maybe 16.
Okay. And so, all right, adventurous eater. Dr. Dye, what about you?
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up in a family where we ate a lot. Food was very important. And you know, you don't understand until you're older what you ate as a child might have been unusual. So it just seemed like normal food to us. But as I grow up, I find out not everybody ate the same things that we ate. And so,
what's an example?
Well, things like liver and lots of fish and once in a while squirrel and, you know, things of that sort. And in our family, you ate what you got. So it wasn't a choice of whether you liked it or not. That wasn't the point. The point was that you had to eat what was sitting there.
Sure.
So we became eaters.
And as we talk about food this hour, I want to be very clear. We're going to be talking about some interesting foods and some foods that are, I think, at minimum, different to most of our listeners. I don't want to discuss this in a way that makes fun or laughs at or sort of expresses horror at some of these, because when we are not familiar with can be challenging for us, but I want to do so with respect and understanding that cultures are different in different places. And I think these kinds of adventures are the best kinds of adventures. And we started with what happened with you on that cup of tea. So can you tell us more about that scene that we described a little bit, Tim?
Yeah, and it's repeated all the time. So when we're offered food, we take it. It's a rare moment, and I can't even think of moments that we refuse when we're offered food. We work in remote places. We're very often the only kind of Westerners that recently or ever came to one of these locations. So when people offer us something, we just take it, we eat it, we drink it. And drinks are very important as well. So most places have a diet that's very informed by the place where they live. So high altitude places have access to food that low altitude places don't have. And camel herders in Africa have access to foods that people who live in forests don't have. So people have food that's very local to where they're at, and they offer it to you and you take it. And it always makes a difference. I think if you were to refuse food, just like with my mother, if you refuse food, it would be rude. So it's rude to people when you refuse to eat their food. So this is important for us to gain trust and also just to expand our own horizons and learn more about what people eat and why they eat it and how they prepare it and how they obtain it and all of the things that go with food.
Tim, I'm maybe embarrassed to say that the first time I thought about the cultural expectation of trying food came from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, where he's traveling, and they're telling him, eat it, eat it. The film, as much of the film itself might have been a letdown, that moment was pretty accurate, that, that when you travel, there is a hope and an expectation that you will show that kind of respect. As you say, it is always welcomed. Have you had any difficult moments? Have you had any moments where you couldn't bring yourself to eat something that was different for you?
Not really, at least not in the... So, you know, if you look at the process of eating, you've got to somehow get that food into your mouth. And sometimes that's not the hard part. The hard part is once it's in your mouth and it might have a taste that is foreign to you or have a texture that's unusual. You know, Americans have certain ways of eating things. We're not used to having bones in our mouth. And a lot of places you just chuck the whole animal in your mouth and bones and everything. And you kind of find the food that's part of it and spit out the bones. That's not how we eat a fish, for example, in the United States. We don't eat fish like that. But in a lot of parts of the world, that's how they might eat something. So sometimes when we get the food in our mouth, that's when the challenge begins. There's a food that's very, very common. It's called butter tea. And in Tibet and in a lot of the Tibetan diaspora around the world, you're offered butter tea as soon as you walk into someone's house or you walk into a temple. And it's a certain kind of butter that's been melted down and then a lot of salt's been put into it. And it's a very unusual taste for most people. It's more like a soup, I'd say. And it doesn't look difficult, but when you start to drink it, it's a very salty sort of unique flavor. And sometimes that can cause a little bit of a reaction, and then you have to control your reaction so that you're not only, you know, making them happy by eating their food, but then you don't want to react in a way that would show that somehow the food upset you. So you have to drink the whole cup, and when in most places you drink the whole cup, and they're going to give you another cup. So because it's considered polite. So I don't have a lot of those experiences of where it was really difficult to take the food, but sometimes once the food's in your mouth and doing the right thing with it can be a little challenging.
Can I ask you as our engineer to grab a microphone, because I'm getting a note that Rob has had butter tea is the term. Is that right, Tim?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah. I practice Tibetan Buddhism, and I know a few refugees from Tibet here, and I've had butter tea, and I've had the crumbled cheese that they make out of butter tea, and it is possibly the worst taste I've ever had in my mouth. And I love these people, and I love the culture, and it's horrible.
but do you find yourself, you know, really working to recognize that for you it's a bad taste, but you're trying to not demonstrate a level of, I guess, disrespect?
Oh yeah, totally. And here in America, I'm really good friends with most of these people, so we kind of joke about it. They know that our palates are different, so it's kind of a funny joke. But if I was visiting like a temple in Tibet or northern India and I was offered it, I would show a lot of respect and choke it down with a smile.
With a smile. Well, thank you for that, Rob. Look at that. So let me ask both Tim and Lauren again, in a way that is trying to be respectful, what are the most interesting food items? And I want to ask both the most interesting food item that you were surprised to genuinely like and the most interesting food item that was, like Rob, a struggle for you. So I'll start with Tim, and then I'll ask Lauren the same question.
That's a surprisingly hard question because I like so many food. And it, let's see. So the food that gets a lot of press with us is, so we ate bats, you know, the bats that fly around and things like that. And parts of the world, bats are prepared very nicely. They're cooked in coconut milk. And like many parts of the world, they're cooked whole. And they're served whole. So you're served a bat in a bowl with some onions and some coconut milk.
Not just a grilled wing or something.
No, exactly. You're served the animal. Like most of the world, that's how it works. Like you get the animal that you're eating. So Lauren and I ate bat. And I think even Alyssa, did you eat some bat too? I think so. We all ate bat. We were in the Pacific Islands. I'd wanted to do it for a while. And I thought it was wonderful. It was really, really good. It was a little unusual. It was kind of a struggle to get to it and to kind of process
it. Get to the meat of it?
Yeah, because it's a bat with fur and wings and all that kind of stuff. So you have to kind of...
But I'm trying to envision. I mean, if it's grilled, it's one thing. Is it boiled? Yeah. Is it...
It was boiled. Yeah, it was boiled in the soup. But it was served as a bat in a bowl with its wings. And we eat the wings. Like the wings are... It's kind of like eating a balloon or something like that. It's you chew I don't want to get too detailed, but you chew the wings and then you cut into the body of the, sorry for the vegetarians out there, but you cut into the body and you get the meat out. And it was very, very good. It tasted a lot like turkey to me. I thought it tasted like Thanksgiving turkey, quite frankly. So that's that one is a little surprising for people, but we've eaten snakes, iguanas, all kinds of animals, sea creatures of all different types that are cooked and uncooked. Sea cucumbers, which is a little unusual.
So bat was the one that not only has that gotten a lot of attention, but you really liked it more than you thought you would.
I personally did. I've had it twice now.
Okay.
And I really enjoyed it.
What was the biggest struggle?
And eating the bat?
No. Another food.
Struggle. I think when we catch things live and you're part of it. So one time I did some field work in this group called the Randile, which is it's a tribe of camel herders in northern Kenya. And they subsist completely on this mixture of camel's blood, which they nick the camel and they catch the blood in a bowl and then they pour milk into it, the camel's milk into it, which is a very rich, creamy kind of milk. It's very creamy. It makes like this substance that's a mix. And it was... You know, it was warm, and it had a kind of funny texture, but it was very good. It's just unusual to be so close to the production of the food that you're going to eat. It's right there, and they're, you know, preparing it and eating it. But again, you start to swallow it, and it didn't taste bad, so I didn't have any problem once it got to that point.
Okay. Lauren, first of all, how was the bat? Like turkey?
I was a little bit shocked just to see it. I guess I'd envisioned, you know, what I see as bats here in American society. You know, we're used to having everything ready, prepared. It's all taken apart. It's just the meat. And then when they brought out this bat in a bowl surrounded by soup, it looked like something had just kind of been thrown in as an afterthought. And they say, okay, enjoy. And I didn't even know how to approach it to eat it. And so I looked to Tim as my food expert and mentor and... you know, try to get the wings off, and it's a small animal to begin with, so how to get to the meat, and you have to kind of be careful picking your way around it. You don't want to get the entrails because, you know, there are bad things that you don't want to be eating in there. So, and again, it's a small creature, so it's almost like a surgical procedure to get the meat out. And then, like Tim said, it kind of tasted like turkey, and I was surprised at how good it was. So that was definitely... I think the bat takes the cake, but just recently I was doing some traveling. I was doing some global research and some field work and a lot of exposure to different cultures and their ways of eating. And I noticed that, you know, doing so much work in the lab, it really took a mind shift to go out and do some field work and experience some of these different cultural foods. And I really liked where that was going. And so I've started doing research in Ecuador. And that was my first site visit as part of my research and these research projects that I have planned. So I'm preparing to go there a total of 3 times. But the first time that I went, I was offered all these different types of foods that I had never eaten before, like kui, which is a guinea pig, cooked guinea pig. you'll see them on rotisseries. They cook the whole body. And there are other things like jumbo maggots, like really, really huge maggots. And they catch them live and eat them live. And so I didn't actually see one. I saw a videotape of that. So it's kind of preparing me for things that I might encounter in the future. I know it's important to say yes and respect culture and take what you're given. So I think it is a really important way to connect with people. Food is always an important way to connect with people. It just has such a huge role in people's lives and cultures. And so I'm really looking forward to learning more about that as I continue my research.
Lauren and Tim, both of you are very open-minded eaters. Have you seen colleagues or others, other Americans, who have not been so open-minded, have either turned down or had negative reactions to food, and have you seen, you know, maybe difficult moments as a result? I'll start with Lauren on this.
Well, how we ate 100 years ago is so different than how we eat today. And things are always in a state of change. You know, what we have available, the exposures that we encounter every day. So, like, going back to that research trip where I ate bat and then coming back here and tried to explain that to different people here, I could see people's reactions, and they often reacted negatively, like, oh, gross, did you seriously eat that? That type of thing. And it's because of how we're raised here and how we're socialized. We've internalized these ways of thinking about what's right and what's wrong when it comes to eating. And for me, if I'm a tourist somewhere and I'm going somewhere, I might have a different perspective. Like, no, no, thank you. That's okay. I won't accept that type of food. But as a researcher, I do believe it's really important to understand where people are coming from and to make that connection and develop that rapport so that we can see the results we're looking for, or just to get a better sense of whatever it is that we're seeking in that place. And it just really helps us change the way we look at things.
Tim, have you seen negative reactions?
Yeah, in difficult situations, I actually have a number of colleagues who are vegan or vegetarian, and I think it's very challenging for them sometimes, both to maintain their own food standards and their food requirements, and also having cultures understand why they won't eat certain things. It's not out of disrespect. So some cultures, in particular in Asia, that are, you know, having vegetarians is not unusual. That's not so difficult. But in other places that are very meat-based for very practical reasons, that could be a difficult place for vegans and vegetarians. I do see tourists occasionally, you know, not reacting to food, almost like you were saying, in terms of mocking food or acting really strange around it and a bit disrespectful. For a lot of people, food is sacred, and it's very important. There's not a lot of it. And offering something that could be wasted by tourists is not uncommon, although people themselves in their own cultures would rarely waste food in the way that we often do. So there's a lot of ways to be unintentionally offensive, I think, but people are forgiving and they understand, just like when our friends from other countries come to eat in our homes and they have the exact same reactions that we have, you know, when they try to eat a hot dog or something like that, that's a very unusual type of food, or something greasy that we eat that they're just not used to. They can have very similar reactions. And you can see that they're really trying to please you and they don't want to offend you. But at the end of the day, it's not something that really suits their palate all that well.
Sure. This is very near and dear to me, this subject, right now, because with a six-year-old son, you want to raise children who are very open-minded eaters, very adventurous eaters. And it's difficult when a lot of American society tells kids that lunch and dinner every day is plain pasta, very little flavor, flavored spices are to be feared. Mm-hmm. And my son likes to cook. And I think he's a pretty good eater. But I try to remind him all the time, when you were one, you ate sushi, man. Mm-hmm. You ate everything. You ate anything we brought to you. And now you have this skepticism because you have this expectation in your mind that you won't like it. Tim, where does that come from? I guess it's fear of the unknown is one thing, But it's tough when you see kids who are growing up with food start to get more picky as they get older. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's socialized. Maybe that's what they're experiencing with friends or school and whatnot. Where do you think that comes from?
Yeah, absolutely. It's social. It's funny you say that because I have a six-year-old and had the exact same experience. He ate sushi and broccoli and things like that.
So, when he he'll say to you, "I don't like this," and you go, yeah. "Yes, you do, man. Yeah. Yeah. I've seen it."
However, I have to say, so he's taken this new approach lately where he likes to try new things, and just tried calamari the other day, knowing what it was. So maybe something happens as they get older and it starts to become a little bit of a game and something adventurous. But, you know, I think it's cultural because a lot of people, when they, a lot of cultures, the kids eat what the adults eat, and that's just the way it is. So they eat a lot of variety, a lot of vegetables. So it kind of relates to our culture's parenting style and what we, how we accommodate our children's palates. And if they want macaroni and cheese, we'll let them have that rather than making them eat the stir fry that we're having or something. Whereas in a lot of other cultures, you eat what you have, and that's what you get. So part of it's socialization, part of it's our parenting, and kind of the way we accommodate what our kids, what we think our kids will like and what they'll eat.
Lauren and Tim, do you see, and you've both talked a little bit about this, but do you see a lot of food waste here in this country? And does that become more apparent when you travel and you see other food cultures? I'll start with Tim.
Absolutely. I mean, we do waste a lot of food here and in a lot of other places. You know, sometimes it's kind of difficult because people will give us a lot of food because we're a visitor. And I know that this is expensive where they're at, and it's a sign of respect. But sometimes you just physically can't eat all the food that they're giving you. So I always feel bad to leave some of it. But also the other thing that people do in a lot of other societies is they use all parts of the animal or the plant in ways that we might not be used to. So eating the entire animal, including the heads, we tend to not eat heads in the United States or in the West. But in a lot of other places, they eat everything. So there's always a lot of waste. When we eat a fish, the things that we leave behind are not the things that other people leave behind. And again, with tourists always eat lots of food and leave a lot behind. So it you do become very self-conscious about that, I think.
Lauren?
When I've been to other countries, I've seen places where they don't have refrigeration. And so they don't have any way to preserve food the way that we would preserve food. So when you go and you get food, you get food for that day. And you know, the next day you get more food. So you get a specific amount of food for that day so that you don't waste anything. But here, you know, we go and we buy things in bulk and we just shove it in the refrigerator and maybe we forget about that food and then it goes to waste because it expires and we throw it away. And this just happens all the time. And it's part of our way of life here. Also, how we prepare food, the ingredients we put into food to make things aesthetically pleasing so that people will eat them. You know, in other countries, you don't see that same type of thing. For example, apples. You know, here our apples are really bright and shiny, but naturally they're not very shiny. So we have it in our mind that, oh, food is supposed to look that way. Food is supposed to be aesthetically pleasing all the time. And if it's not, then we throw it away, even though it still might be good.
Let's get our only break of the hour, and when we come back, what I want to do is a couple of things. I want to ask our guests their favorite experience in which food broke down some barriers, and I've read some of what our guests have written about these experiences, whether it's beer, I think, in Tibet or other places, and the way that this kind of connection can help their research, can help the way they communicate with different communities. So food as a way of being the handshake, the way of breaking down those barriers. So we'll ask them about that. And I will open it up to listener feedback. If you want to share your thoughts as we talk about different food cultures, maybe experiences you've had, or if you have thoughts about how to bring yourself to be a more open eater, I think that's good for everybody. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And Tim, before the hour's out, I've got some of your recipes somewhere here. You've got some recipes, so maybe we'll talk about what you teach. You do some cooking demos, yeah?
We did. Yeah, we did one.
Okay.
And I cook a lot.
All right. So we'll talk about that as well. Our guests are Dr. Tim Dye, Associate Chair of Research in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. He's a medical anthropologist and a social epidemiologist, joined by Lauren Farovich. And Lauren is a PhD candidate in translational biomedical science at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. Let's go ahead and take that break, and we'll come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on the next Connections, either you view this as appropriate justice or an overreach in the Me Too movement. The Mets scoreboard operator loses his job after some crude comments. He joins us, and we'll talk to attorneys about what you can and cannot say at work. Then in our second hour, do kids recognize what a phone booth is? How about a typewriter? Modern and not so modern technology in the eyes of kids. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We call it the Summer of Food. Every Thursday at 1 p.m. throughout the summer, a different conversation about food and food culture. And this one we've been looking forward to for a long time. We have a couple of guests who have traveled the world and have had many experiences in different communities, in different cultures, in which maybe there's a moment that calls for them to try a kind of food that they have never seen or tasted before. And those are the moments where you really have to say yes. You find a way to break down those barriers, to show respect, to try something new. And I want to ask both of our guests, Dr. Tim Dye and Lauren Farovich, about that. And I asked them before the break about their favorite story in this way. And Tim, there's been a lot over the years, but is there one that stands out more than others?
Well, there are a lot. And I think one of the things that surprises me is how, when you're in maybe a contentious situation or even in arguments with people or negotiations, at least, when you sort of stop all of that and then you take food, that has this amazing homogenizing or harmonizing effect. So I remember one time in China, and this has happened a lot in many places. Where we work in China is a difficult place, and there are different ethnicities involved, different governments involved, and some of the negotiations can be quite difficult. And without a doubt, every single night we would have these big dinners around a round table, lots of dishes. People are very proud of the dishes that they're serving. Lots of drinks and lots of ceremony that surrounds the eating and drinking of different kinds of things. And you really become friendly in that situation. And you're not talking about work. You're just talking about the food or your families or whatever that relates to. And I always am amazed how you can go into a situation quite angry even or upset. And then after a meal, everybody's friends and everybody kind of gets along. And I think a lot of cultures get that that's one of the functions of mealtime. And that's one of the things that happens when you share food. It's hard to stay angry when you're eating food and when you're eating good food or when you're eating something that really represents somebody's culture. So that time in China, and it's happened a lot in different places, but I think that's one of the ones that definitely stands out about how you can go from not seeing any way forward to all of a sudden, everybody's friends, and then the next day, things go quite nicely, actually.
Lauren?
Right. I guess I'm just thinking about myself as a white man and going to other countries and being—and people are sick of seeing basically white people come and appropriate their culture and, you know, oppress their people. What are you doing here? Do you think you're better than what people are doing here? And that kind of very oppressive thinking. And, you know, naturally, I'm resistant to being seen that way. But I understand that people are suspicious of, like, why I'd be coming into their culture. And I think that eating together helps really dissolve a lot of those barriers. And it's a really... it's a really unique feeling to be able to connect to people with food.
You bring up appropriation. And obviously, if you travel to a different community, a different part of the world, and you sit at a table and eat with them, that's not what we would call appropriation. But at the same time, I am curious, Lauren, given that you've brought it up, how legitimate a concern you think that question is in this country. It comes up a lot. And often in food with appropriation. What do you think we should keep in mind about that?
I think it's important to give food credit and where it's from, where it's been developed, the heritage behind it, and to support cultural diversity and different cultures and different countries' views on food, and the understanding that the way that we eat here is different than the way people eat in other countries, and that the United States is kind of a melting pot of different cultures. And I think it's important to remember that how we've developed here. You know, we are a relatively young country. It's only, you know, less than 300 years old. So everything we are is from different countries. And I think it's really important to remember and honor and respect that.
Okay. Tim, some thoughts on that?
Yeah, actually, that's a really good point. I think what also happens when you're in another country, the fact that other people have to teach you how to eat, because we don't know sometimes physically how to eat something, or we don't know that you never eat this before that, and they get to teach you, we're always sort of vulnerable in a situation when we're in the field. So people are taking care of us by showing us how you do this or how you do that. So it's a nice place for us to be in, because we're not in some sort of a situation where we're coming in and just doing things our way. The other thing that happens with this appropriation idea that I noticed most recently is the fad with poke on the mainland United States. So we lived in Hawaii for a while, and poke is a very big poke is a rare it's raw fish that's served in a bowl with some other things, and poke is very common in Hawaii. All the stores would carry poke, and people would eat it and things like that. And now poke has been sort of gentrified or something, and you find poke bowls, very like designer type bowls and fusion things, which could be really interesting. But I always think of the very Hawaiian nature of poke in Hawaii when I see that. It's kind of like when you take yoga out of its context. It can still be interesting, but it's not quite the same thing as it is where it's generated. We find this with Chinese food and all types of food that we find commonly in the United States that might be quite different in the place where it originated.
I remember being on the Mediterranean Sea, and the first time I had bouillabaisse, it was at like a Michelin star restaurant, and I went, "Come on, man! I want the greasy spoons. I want bouillabaisse the way that it was traditionally made." But I take the point, Tim. I think that's well said. We're talking to Dr. Tim Dye and Lauren Farovich from the University of Rochester, who are telling us about their experiences with food around the world. Food as a chance to break down barriers and offer a chance to see into other cultures and to be more welcomed into other cultures when we are open to different food experiences. Let me read a couple of emails that have come in. Cindy says, "Isn't it possible as children age and are able to wander farther away from their parents, they become more wary of foods just as a protective instinct?" So I think what Cindy is saying, Tim, is that if kids get older, what they're used to is safe to them. Mm. And the farther we go, the less safe we may feel in a lot of different ways, not the least of which is food. Do you agree?
Well, sure. That might be a valid explanation, but it's also great when kids and any of us can really venture outside of our comfort zone and eat something that might be unusual or surprising to us. And then not only survive it, but like it. And then you've just expanded a little bit. So, you know, when kids learn to try other things, or when they see other kids eating sushi and they're surviving and loving it, then you really can expand and grow when you explore that way.
Hmm. Lauren, what do you think?
Right. I think a community is usually used to eating a certain way. And that's okay. And so that's just what we're used to. We're used to certain textures and flavors. And if something's different, I think it just takes time to get used to it. And I think, you know, just being willing to try different things and take opportunities as they come up is really great.
An email from Brett. And Brett says, let me pull it back up. Brett says, "Evan, thank you for this discussion. I would try bat. I would try anything that your guests have described, and I think I could convince myself to even like all of that. The key that I have found is repetition, repetition, repetition." Thank you, Brett. So with that, I'll ask our guests if they agree, but before I do that, let me go ahead and read from an article from Bustle.com, how to make yourself like foods you hate. Hmm. Five ideas there. Number one, exposure. That's an obvious one. Simply just being exposed to new things and being open-minded to it. Number two, adjustment using liked tastes. And I will read from the article now on this one. Quote, if you really hate a food, there is one fairly simple and reliable trick for making you like it more. Combine it with a nice taste, and you will eventually begin to appreciate the hated food on its own. Science magazine reported that children who were introduced to sweetened broccoli gradually began to like the actual taste of raw broccoli itself better. That's number two. Number three, they write, what's not to like? A primary piece of information you'll need to actually change your palate is, what is it specifically about the food that you don't like or that makes you not like it? This may seem like a stupid question. It's the taste, dummy, you may be saying. But it's actually more complicated than that. It may actually be the smell, the appearance, especially because we are highly influenced by the appearance of food. It might be the texture, how it feels between your teeth, even if it's resemblance to a different food that you already don't like. Understanding what you don't like or are scared of can help you. Number four, they say experiment with recipes, take foods you don't think you will like, and again, try cooking them yourself. And number five, become a flavor expert. In an article about food tasting for the newspaper The Guardian, food developer Barb Stuckey advised us to do the direct opposite of avoiding the foods that we hate. Instead, she suggested that we try to become an expert on the flavors and nuances of the foods we hate. Become that dude who tastes a glug of wine and pronounces tastes of blueberry, maple, maybe a hint of angry muskox. Except do that with food. Obviously, it can't happen until you've gotten over the initial disgust threshold and you've begun to do targeted work on introducing this food into your life. But learning as much as you can about the taste, texture, and origins of the object of hatred might begin to replace your disgust for the food with a grudging fascination with its complexity. All right, so those are five ideas from Bustle.com on how to make yourself like foods you hate. Guests, agree, disagree, and what would you add? Tim?
I guess for me, you know, eating things isn't a checklist. So for me, it very much is about the culture that the food comes from and experiencing it. So, for example, if you've ever been through an Ethiopian coffee ceremony and seen how Ethiopians prepare coffee, which is very elaborate, it's wonderful, very aromatic, it's got ritual to it. It still tastes like a great cup of coffee that you could have obtained in a lot of other ways. But there's something about having it that way that's particularly Ethiopian and gives you part of this experience. So I think it's nice to have things in the way that they're offered, not just to say you've eaten a bat, but I think it's important to eat the bat in the right cultural context. I wouldn't go to my attic and catch one and cook it myself and think that was something I really wanted to do. But to have it in a place where it's appropriate and where it's prepared and it's part of a culture, that's what I really like. So I like to not remove things and just sort of have a tick list of things I want to accomplish with food. I like to have it. It's more like the cultural experience of having it in the right context and having it the way someone wants to offer it.
Lauren?
I agree. I think knowing the story behind the food, how it's made, where it comes from, really helps one to look at it differently and to be more willing to try things that might be strange. You know, growing up, my mom always told me, don't judge food based on what it looks like. And so always, I grew up when I was very young, I was a very picky eater. And there was a lot of things I wouldn't eat. And mom really got on my case about it. And my mom's a very healthy eater, too. So she would sometimes hide vegetables in other food, knowing that I wouldn't eat it if I knew it was there. And sometimes, you know, she would tell me to cover my eyes and eat something, and I would do that and like it. And she's like, see, it doesn't matter what it looks like. And so that was a big lesson to not just judge food based on how it looks.
I love it.
And you know, if I could just say, yeah. Look, food is so cultural. If you think about it, like how many of us had salad for breakfast? So we don't have salad for breakfast typically, and you don't typically have like pancakes for dinner. So it's partially based on the time of the day when something's appropriate, and there's absolutely no reason why we can't have, you know, a big Caesar salad for breakfast because we'll eat it, 4 hours later for lunch? So food is so cultural. When we eat things, we'll eat chicken, but we won't eat pigeon. You know, where some places will eat pigeon, but they won't eat blue jay or something like that. So a lot of it's up in our head in terms of what we feel is the restriction, because we don't eat it that way, or we don't eat that's breakfast, that's morning food, or that's night food, or that's a snack, or and even in some places there are drinks that they don't consider drinks; they consider liquid, this particular liquid kind of thing, like chung in Tibet, they consider it food. They don't consider it a drink. So
chung is food.
Chung is food. It's a fermented barley drink that tastes like beer. It's really interesting. But when you talk to a Tibetan about beer, beer comes in a bottle. And we don't drink any beer. We drink chung. And chung is healthy and chung makes you strong. But beer can be dangerous because it can, you know, do other things to you. So same alcohol in both, but presented in a different way, in a different context.
In the same way that salad is what we think would be the starter for a dinner, but in Italy, it's what you finish with as a digestif.
Yep.
And same meal, different place in the meal, and some Americans are just going, huh?
All right.
Yeah, exactly. Magnus on Twitter writes to us and says, Magnus says, Evan, I fully enjoy sitting with people in different cultures and having a meal with them. It is truly the best way to get to know and laugh along with your fellow humans. I did this eating camel in the Sahara Desert. It was an amazing experience. End quote from Magnus. Yeah. Have you had camel?
I have had camel. Yes, I've had camel and wildebeest and all kinds of things out in the desert. Yeah.
Lauren, camel, wildebeest?
No, I'd like to. I want to.
Okay. So describe the taste, if you could, or the experience with camel and wildebeest.
I remember the wildebeest had surprisingly, well, maybe not surprisingly, not a whole lot of meat on it, and very what we would call in our culture gamey tasting. But at what people were very proud to serve it to us, and were very happy that we ate it. And the camel's a very, very important animal to them. So, you know, all life kind of emanates from the camel in that particular culture, and it was very important that we ate it. Taste-wise, all this stuff tastes great. I think it's roasted, it's fresh, you know.
Jeffrey Steingarten wrote a book called The Man Who Ate Everything, and his book was about being a writer for a newspaper in which he was asked to become a food critic, but he was a meat and potatoes eater, and he had to make himself like foods that he would not normally want to try. And I don't remember, it's been a while since I've encountered the book, but there were something like 7 or 9 foods in the world that he could not make himself like, but he said it was a very short list. Otherwise, he said just about everything he can do, and it takes a number of times, trying it and trying it again. So in many ways, it's an attempt to encourage us, if we think we don't like something, to try to encounter it again on a restaurant list, at homes, at our homes, or with friends. But he did say there was a small list of food that he just could not do. Do you have any lists on your own, foods you just so far cannot do? Tim?
I'm not thinking of a whole lot right at the moment. I think the foods that I absolutely won't eat, I can't think of a whole lot of things. I think some of the sea creatures can be odd, especially if they're not cooked. They can have a strange texture, and sometimes it can make you feel a little funny if you're not used to it. So sea cucumber is a little bit like that. It's not one of my favorite things to eat, but I can't think of anything that I wouldn't eat.
Okay.
I really can't.
Lauren?
Squid, it's kind of a sour fish. And it smells really strong when it's raw and it's been left out for a while. So it's just really that strong smell that makes you kind of instinctually feel that you shouldn't eat it. So that's when I'm a little bit hesitant. I think I'm hoping to overcome that and eventually eat it, but that is one for me.
All right. Let me read an email from Karen. Karen says, I'm a public folklorist and director of GLOW Traditions, documenting culture and presenting programs in Genesee, Livingston, Orleans, and Wyoming counties. Foodways are a significant subject area for folklorists, in which we look at food traditions and culinary practices along a spectrum of cultural meaning and practice, from everyday recipes to ritual use in major life events. Utilizing food-based cultural practices has been extremely helpful in my programming with our region's Hispanic population, many of whom are farm workers with rich culinary traditions. In understanding and sharing the special foods in, for example, the Mexican Day of the Dead celebration, we can engage directly with quote-unquote the other and break through barriers of language, negative stereotypes, and bias. Mm-hmm. That's from Karen. Tim?
That's absolutely wonderful. Yeah, I think that's, to me, that's what's so exciting when you live in a multicultural area and we have all these immigrant groups around that bring their food traditions with them. You know, there's so much variety that you can access in upstate New York in terms of restaurants and people who prepare food in special ways. Not only can you learn about the culture, but these foods are wonderful. I mean, the kind of food that you would get on a Day of the Dead celebration from a Mexican family would be fantastic. It would be a phenomenal experience. It would taste good. And you'd have some great learning about that community from the food that you'd be eating.
Shout out to my friend Pablo. I totally agree.
Yeah.
And I'll be there for the next one. Lauren, what do you make of the email we just heard?
I think it's spot on in what Tim said. One thing I'd like to add is that when you try new food, just to make sure that you put forth the effort to understand the story behind it, like I've said before, you don't just show up and eat it and say yay or nay and then leave. That is a kind of cultural appropriation. Oh, I like that food. I'm going to make more of that, or I'm just going to have that again. But to really understand the history and the people behind the food and to make an effort to interact with the people that have presented that food to you, I think is a big part of it.
All right. Joel writes to us and says, given Tim Dye's research and work, can he talk about how the health of indigenous peoples can be affected by the desecration of sacred places in the U.S. and globally, and what role does connection to place play in human health?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, one of the observations that I've made in my work, a lot of places where we work, we work with nomadic populations, or at least we interact with nomadic populations and settled populations. Almost to every example I can think of, the nomads are healthier. So when you're nomadic, you tend to live much more in concert with your environment and the foods that are available in your environment, like the Rendille in Africa with the camel's blood. That's what they have access to. That's what they live on. When the Rendille settle in villages, then they eat processed food. They get all the chronic diseases that come with that. They lose part of their culture by not eating traditional foods anymore. So almost to a T, and I would include Americans in this, when we become settled, and our diets become convenient, then we become less healthy, almost to a T. And food and the way we cook certain food is cultural history, and these are things that need to be preserved. And we know this from the fact that there are only a few different varieties of bananas and potatoes that are available commercially, where 100 years ago there were hundreds of varieties of things that we could access prepared in different ways. So it's unfortunate that we are losing a lot of our food history. And as cultures integrate globally, a lot of the food richness and diversity that we see, it leaves with the people who know how to prepare it mm-hmm. and harvest it and all of that.
Do you both cook a lot?
I do.
Lauren?
Well, so-so.
A wry smile on his face. I think Lauren and Tim have made a very good point that you don't want to just create a recipe in your kitchen of bat or a food that might be very much not a part of your own local culture to sort of be kind of a food tourist in a way. In other words, the context matters, the place matters. Mm-hmm. But we'll wrap with this. Tim, you did offer a couple recipes for students.
Yeah.
What were the two recipes?
Well, one was momos. I can't remember what the other one was.
I see mandazi and chai Yamazewa?
That was my colleague who worked in Africa. Oh, she offered that. Yeah.
Okay.
I did the Tibetan momos.
Oh, you did momos.
Yeah. Which it's funny because, you know, it's funny you say this because, you know, gallo pinto, which is rice and beans in Costa Rica, wonderful. I don't know how they make this. And I've asked all of my students, my friends in Costa Rica, I've had my friends' moms show me how they prepare it. I buy my beans in Costa Rica. I bring them home. I cannot make gallo pinto like people in Costa Rica make it. There's something that's missing. And people tell us, well, you got to do this, you got to do that. But a lot of times when we try to replicate these foods, they come close, but they don't quite get it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of interesting that there's this missing thing that you can only get from people who really know how to make that food.
I think there's a parallel to wine. And as a wine writer, I tie everything back to wine. But you can grow Riesling or Cabernet. You can plant grapes in your backyard. And those grapes will grow, and you can make juice and ferment them into wine, but they will not be the same as growing it in places where the grapes are more suitable to grow. And maybe there is a connection to food there. You can try to replicate at home.
That's true.
But be in there. And as Anthony Bourdain often said, the late Anthony Bourdain said, that's the best way to break down your fears of other cultures. Get out and travel. And we've learned so much this hour from Dr. Tim Dye and Lauren Farovich. I want to thank both of you for being here. And thank you for sharing your experiences and pushing us to think outside of our own sort of safe boxes of food and culture. Lauren, thank you. It's been great having you here. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Dye, I know we'll see you soon. Thank you very much as well. Nice to see you back here again.
Thank you.
The Summer of Food, and you can hear all of the Summer of Food conversations. We've got them cataloged on our website, podcasted there every Thursday at 1 p.m. throughout the summer months. Rob Braden is the engineer, Megan Max the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Enjoy the afternoon. We're back with you Friday on member-supported public radio.